For those of you who are not familiar with Melissa's work, I highly recommend. I mean, even before I go into her actual intro, which is very, very short and sweet, is the fact that I find Melissa's work to be like a walking business school. It's a business school that information that you absolutely need, and the simplest way to learn all of that for free is to follow her on LinkedIn. It's been so transformative for me in the past year, and Melissa's been writing for years. And with that said, I've listed all her contact information, LinkedIn, below in the description, wherever you're watching or listening to this. Briefly, Melissa is the co-founder and CEO of eWebinar, one of my favorite online webinar software. I highly recommend you definitely test it out. She is a third-time bootstrapper, 13 years in startups. Previous company were acquired in 2019. Digital nomad herself, traveling around the world. Can't wait to get into that. And right now, her key focus is giving people back their time through webinar automation so that they can grow their business without being there 24/7. That to me is so inspiring. So welcome to the show, Melissa. I'm just really, really thrilled you're here.
Thanks so much for having me, Faye. And actually, I've only been writing for 16 months. So,
Only a little over a
yeah,
year.
so I wish I had been writing for years because I think that was one of the bigger mistakes that I made,
Why is that?
is not building an audience early enough. I just didn't know this existed. I just didn't know that like audience mattered, I guess. My last company, I was selling enterprise SaaS, so really a sales-led company, not marketing-led or product-led. And it was only until this company that is product led that I realized, oh, I think marketing is a thing. No one picks up the phone for a $100 product, turns out.
Wow, yeah, exactly. That is such an interesting learning right there. I mean, looking at your writing, how proficient and prolific you are at it, I just assume you're probably like Seth Godin, who's been writing for like 20 years. 16 months is really impressive. But let's talk about the frequency. First of all, your posts are long and to the point. It's very well curated, and you have a certain style. I also love the fact that you're not really just like everybody else, right? It's not like, oh, this is another Justin Welch, or like, oh, I see the format. They're like, no, Melissa has her own format. Could you talk about like writing on LinkedIn, how you got started, and how you got inspired to create your own style over time?
That is so interesting because this is my post tomorrow. So you are like living in the future. So I mean I want to condense this to make it useful, but I had this realization that I needed to build an audience. I hadn't like had I had actually run out of ideas to sell my product. I was doing personal outreach, tried LinkedIn outreach, tried email outreach, and it just wasn't working. Like, of course, founder-led sales is how you get any company off the ground. But just to give people context, my software is self-serve. It started back then at $49, but now it's $99. So it's like it's a low-cost product that people come in, sign up for a free trial, and convert on their own. So while I probably got the first 100 customers just from my own network and their friends, like referrals, it only goes so far. So I had actually run out of ideas on like how to get people to come to our website. And then I started looking at what other companies were doing, and and I had logged in onto LinkedIn for the first time in years. So I think the first time I logged into LinkedIn was like January of 2022.
No
So
way.
like last year. And I was like, this is like a whole new world. It's no longer a resume website. Like, why are people sharing like blogs or like micro blogs on there? And then my friend was like, oh, you need to check out this guy, Justin Welch. So then I started following his content, and I'm like, oh, actually, this like really resonates. And then I started finding these creators, like yourself, that was building an audience just by sharing their like experience. And so I wanted to learn how this worked. So then I took Justin's course on LinkedIn operating system, which then became the foundation by which I would, make, I guess, create my own, like create my own templates and things like that. So, actually, so I took his course and then I found a bunch of creators that I followed. I tried different content styles and templates, and it's interesting that you've noticed that I have my own style because it's called your audience for a reason. It's your audience that resonates with your style, your voice. And I tried a lot of things that worked and didn't work, and I tried a lot of different templates. Like, a lot of creators also sell their templates. The lowest engagement that I get is through someone else's writing style.
Interesting.
And, you know, like for someone like Justin, like he has a certain authority. So he can just say some motivational quote and people would like flock to it.
True.
Like I'm a nobody, right? So if I use the exact same motivational style or quote, it's just not going to work. So I realized through testing different content that what works for me and my audience is counterintuitive advice backed up by personal stories. If I don't have a personal story that goes with my own conclusion, it doesn't get any engagement. And that's actually why like all of my writing is personal stories and personal conclusions. I always write in first person. It's never a generalization because also people can challenge a general conclusion, but they cannot challenge my personal opinion. So that's kind of how I came up with that. And I was writing 4 to 6 times a week when I started for about a year. So I started June last year until June this year. And then I accidentally hit like a viral post that was a really long post, like a listicle style long post. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So then I just copied that format and I did it 8 times in a row. And then it just became this like overnight kind of LinkedIn sensation for like 2 months. And I think I added like, I think about 20,000 followers in 2 months. Those posts got like 3.7 million impressions.
Wow.
And I lowered my frequency because what happens is if you have content that's getting engagement and you put out something new, the new one gets like priority by the platform. So the new one actually crushes the old one. I actually don't put out anything new unless the previous one that I have like kind of like runs out of engagement, like people stop commenting or things like that. So if you have a viral post that actually you get engagement for 4 to 5 days, but you want to stay top of mind, but actually writing like one piece of long form content, which is what I do once a week now, takes about 10 hours.
Oh,
so I don't really have the time because I treat it as an article. Yeah. So it takes me 2 to 3 hours to write like a first draft. And then 5 to 7 hours to edit it and then cut it down because it only allows something like 530 like words. So then I have to spend a lot of time cutting out things that are unimportant. And that actually forces you to think about the things that are important. So I can only get one of those out per week. And then so that's why I either post Monday, Wednesday now or Tuesday, Thursday. So the one I do earlier in the week is usually like just to stay top of mind. And then the one I do later in the week is usually like a long form style, like blog style content. And then if, you know, it gets a lot of engagement, then I'll just keep running through the weekend. So that's kind of like the evolution of what I discovered, like how I discover what works and my own content style and why I've actually lowered the frequency. But now I actually write longer form, more intentional, more thoughtful content than just like, here's something that I did before.
Wow. I want to just, for people who are watching this and we're listening to this, I want to give you an example that most of Melissa's posts are getting, from what I can see, like 60 comments or more within like almost initial publication. So I want to compare that and contrast that to people who are CEOs at these so-called, you know, very big companies with, you know, sometimes millions of followers, and they don't necessarily get that level of engagement. It just shows that with your, you know, current, Melissa, your current audience, maybe even, you know, smaller compared to these folks, the, you know, the Bill Gates of the world, still people are really engaging. I noticed yesterday looking through their profiles, nearly all of them are CEOs and founders with occasional like a director or VPs of marketing or something. So I thought that was really fascinating. But what you said, I wanted to break down because I have a ton of follow-up questions, one of which is, as I'm reading your blog posts, I really don't feel like this is a business engagement. This is a personal engagement. It feels really personal. And the way that you write with simple English, I know you're highly educated, but you know, very simple language. I feel like I could sit here with a 12-year-old and we could have a conversation about what Melissa just wrote. And there's spaces in between them. And in a way that I published a documentary series on Amazon, I'm constantly thinking about talking to filmmakers about how to hook people in a very emotional way. So for me, as I'm reading through your post, I imagine a woman, an entrepreneur, kind of walking through life. Like I could picture and visualize your story as opposed to just reading it. So I would love to hear like how you put yourself in that mind space to basically kind of craft almost like a film, something so visual, so visceral for your audience.
Well, first of all, thank you for noticing that. It's like, tell me more.
Keep
telling me, it's awesome. I think it's really important to write as if you're having a conversation, because that's what you're doing, right? It's how we write our websites. It's how we write our help articles, like as if we're having a conversation, because we are having a digital conversation. Mm-hmm. And I don't like, I know people say like, oh, you should write like grade five level, but like, I don't really focus on that because I want to write for the advanced business reader, mm-hmm. like the advanced business user. But also English is my second language. Like Chinese is my first language. So I need to use simple words and vocabulary because my vocabulary is actually quite limited. And I have to like, thank God for texting, because a lot of times like I'll be texting with someone and I have to look up a word. So I want to make sure that when I put something out there, it's not something that people need to look up. Mm-hmm. Like it's not a word that's hard. But I also think that, like, to your point about visualization, like, I want, because we remember things by connecting with a story and by visualizing, by seeing something. I think about all my writing as mini stories, like a mini movie. Mm-hmm. I want people to be able to connect with that point in time and be able to put themselves in my shoes. So that they can remember that content. A lot of times I'll get like a DM or something, like a private message that will, have someone say like, I've been trying to verbalize my own journey. And by reading this, like I really connect with it. It's almost like you're writing what I've lived through. And that's awesome, right? Because that's the goal, is to let people know that there are many faces of success and they're not alone. And all these things are normal, and all these things you've gone through and felt and all the hardships and all the failures are normal, and here's why. And just in the same way that I always explain a business case to our product people and our developers, I don't want them to be coding for the sake of coding, mm-hmm. right? I want them to know why we do what we do and how a customer is going to use it and how they're going to benefit from it in their business. And that's why we chose this over that. So kind of in the same way I want my team to understand what we're doing, is in the same way I want my audience to know why I'm writing this and how I drew this conclusion.
It's so beautifully said. I feel like this whole thing unexpectedly is such a masterclass for LinkedIn and really for writing and how to be a creator in general, because I don't know if you... When you reach the point, you're able to overcome that, self-imposter syndrome, where some people feel like they have to copy somebody else because that's a proven formula. Whereas like for me as an entrepreneur since 2016 officially, I realized that's total BS, right? We can't copy anybody. Our journey is so unique, and you are guaranteed to almost fail if you follow such a formula because it doesn't exist. So how did you kind of come to the conclusion or really build that stamina and muscles to be like, I'm going to be myself. This is my story. I'm putting it out there. Agree or disagree.
Yeah. So it's really like what I mentioned before, like when I tried to copy mm-hmm. someone else's writing style because they told me to, mm-hmm. right? Like I downloaded these templates, or I follow Justin's, templates. And I also subscribed to his templates for a few months.
Oh,
and I was told to do this, and this gets enough engagement. This is the hook line, and this is the meat, and all that stuff, right? Like, and then I just never got engagement for those particular posts. But you need to try, right? Because what doesn't work for me could work for someone else, and it depends on your audience and your persona. Like, I don't have that, like, that kind of Tony Robbins persona, but Justin does. So the stuff that works for him is... is for that audience, like your daily quote or your daily inspiration. Like I cannot do that, I guarantee you, because I've tried. So one of my, I guess, hacks for LinkedIn, which is what my post tomorrow is, I never copy anybody. because I believe that it's your audience for a reason. And I do believe that by copying people, you can get started. Because you need to start from somewhere, right? But it won't get you very far. And it won't get you people that relate to your journey. And a good, I think another story that I can share that's kind of in line with that is when I was in my 20s, one of my first jobs was selling real estate in Vancouver. And I had, you know, I was an apprentice to a fairly successful realtor. I didn't know anything, right? I didn't know anything about sales or selling real estate or how to handle an objection. I was so young. And I would copy everything he told me to do. Because he would say, like, if they say this, say this in return. This is how you close the deal. And for 9 months, when I was following him, I didn't sell a single property of my own. And I also like always felt a little uncomfortable with the way that he was handling objection, but because it was his personality, but I didn't really know it at the time. And then I stopped following him and, you know, started selling houses on my own. And in that year, I sold 36 properties of my own. So then I realized I couldn't sell anything because I was trying to be him. I was not me. So everything I said like was inauthentic because it was. And I like it was, I always found it a bit cringy. And so I realized from that experience that the market is so big that you will attract your own audience, your own customers, your own tribe if you're authentically yourself. What people hate are liars. Right? People that are inauthentic, people that try to be something else, right? When you try to be over the top or, you know, like just someone who's not vulnerable, who's not you, like that's what repels people. So I learned to be my own salesperson and be comfortable with people not willing to work with me because I'm too young or too fresh or too inexperienced, because there were people that wanted to give me a chance as well. So I think that it kind of parallels, right? Like you can always get started and like learn some things, but ultimately you have to be yourself.
This conversation reminds me of people with versus without experience. I feel like a lot of the initial fears come from just anticipating the grief, the fear, things that might go wrong. Whereas the way that you come across as yourself, as your posts, and you're confident. I'm not saying you're overly confident, but it's just like, here's a story. And it feels so refreshing to see words written and stories shared in such a way. And I have to ask, I realize we're probably quite similar in age. And I was thinking, looking at your three bootstrapped startups, and I was thinking about all the years you've spent in business, like you've been at it for a long time. So if I'm doing my math correctly, you've been an entrepreneur probably since your early to mid 20s.
Yeah.
If not before that. And I think being a real estate person, that's very entrepreneurial. But I just want to kind of get into your mind to think about, like, when did you as a young woman to go, this corporate path, that might not be for me. I'm not going to be a VP. And needless to say, coming from an Asian background as a generalization, I know even my parents as creators and artists, they go, you should probably work for a Citigroup or something. I've even had those,
yes, I definitely had that.
Fidelity or something. Yeah. So I would
tell all my friends.
Exactly. Something I can actually explain. Yeah. My daughter's a podcaster and YouTuber. That's much harder.
Why don't you take your life seriously?
Exactly. Yeah. This is not a rehearsal. It's real. So I would love to hear your backstory. I'm like, well, that's really young for Melissa to have done something, to have overcome probably a lot of things that we don't even know, you know?
Yeah. So I just turned 40 in July. And I was an entrepreneur since, I guess, my first company. I was always entrepreneurial, but I was never an entrepreneur. So I always, like, you know, as a kid, sold origami to my classmates and then like for like 25 cents and then like bought popsicles on, you know, at recess. Like, so I was always like entrepreneurial, but I did follow a path. My parents wanted me to be a professional. So, you know, a banker, a doctor or something that I could be like really proud of and explain. And, you know, right out of school, I did work for different companies as well. And, you know, in real estate, out of real estate, but they were all like small, medium sized companies where I could still be my own person and be creative. The first and last time I ever worked for a corporate, which my parents are very proud of, was at SAP, like a big company where I like sold software as an inside sales executive. Only lasted a year. And that was the last job I ever had. I realized that, like, I'm just not made to manage managers, and I'm not made for the 9 to 5. And, you know, in those companies, you have to be like a gear in the machine. And some people really love that, but not me, right? And I think that's why, like, startup people will never work for corporate, and corporate people will never thrive in a startup, because the things you value fundamentally are just different. Like, in a corporate, you value stability, right? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe titles. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, being a VP or, like, whatever that is, right? Like, and maybe you don't value freedom, sleeping in. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't set an alarm. I love to sleep in.
Me
so,
too.
You know, like, that's just, like, there's just fundamental differences in how you want to work. But I remember, like, I was just so sick of working for other people. I wanted to try something of my own, and I wanted to focus on it. I was, I think, 26, 27. I had some money saved up because I was always in commission jobs. Mm-hmm. Like, I had some money saved up that I thought would last for like 2 years. It only lasted 9 months. But I never had a real company before, and I felt like I was ready. So I quit SAP to start my first company. Didn't really know what I was going to do. Just tried a bunch of different ideas with, you know, a CTO contractor who I paid, who eventually became my first co-founder, and we did two companies together, but he was my contractor to begin with. And I didn't feel young. I felt probably the oldest in my mid-20s. I feel young now, right? Yeah. You know, like, it's like you don't know what you don't know, but, like, I just felt old. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was old enough to do something on my own. And I guess I never looked back, but it was like 13 years ago.
Wow.
And I just kind of powered through. Like, I never had experience. And it was, you know, for the first 7 years of my 13-year journey was super tough because I just really didn't know what I was doing. But, you know, you just kind of power through. And my second company, Spacio, I ran for 5 years. And that one was the one that was acquired in 2019. And that really was the one that gave me the confidence and the capital to start the company that I'm running today.
Well, which is eWebinar. I absolutely love the company. And I just want to say, like, quickly on eWebinar, people are watching this, I'm going to include a link below. I remember when I found out about eWebinar because I was once upon a time kind of prolific when it comes to creating Zoom and Zoom meetings, Zoom webinar related content. And people are like, I need alternatives. I don't want to keep running the same webinar over and over again. I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, I have that problem. All my clients have that problem. And when I discovered eWebinar, it was just literally, I was like, it was such an eye-opening moment. And even immediately, you know, I did a YouTube video. At the time, I didn't know you and, you know, didn't really meet you at all, but it was just immediately to say these are fantastic alternatives. And imagine you can see this ad or somebody send you the webinar, and now for the next 4 to 6 hours, and they're recurring, you can sign up at any time, and the engagement is high. And now, funny enough, like, now I'm engaging with your LinkedIn posts on a regular basis. I just feel like you haven't mentioned eWebinar once, not once,
but
right. Meanwhile, I've become this organically, like, advocating eWebinar. Like, I had to mention, I had a prospecting call right before this. I'm like, have you heard of eWebinar? That's what's missing. And here's what I'm like, what's happening here? And there's like,
that's cool.
Yeah, I love it. It's really, I feel like being able to learn from your journey, what you just talked about, but also in a written format on LinkedIn, I feel like I owe it to you for that's that connection, awesome. For the learning. That's free. I'm serious. This is,
that's
I don't
cool
know
to know
why
it's working like that, because, like, I actually have some people that would say, you don't talk about your company enough. And I'm like, well, first of all, I don't have time to, because I just want to share, like, my experience. And that's, like, that's the joy of writing. But also, people are kind of allergic to advertising.
True.
Right? Like, more and more, like, if I write something about eWebinar, like, directly, this is my company, this is what I do, I'll probably get very little engagement.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And actually, there was a report, I think it was, like, from Trust Radius, the B2B Buying Disconnect, one of my favorite reports. It actually said, like, one of the questions or one of the surveys that they did was, what are some things a company could do to lower your chance of buying from them?
Mm-hmm.
Advertising was one of them. Could you believe it? Like, was like top five. So people actively don't buy your product if you advertise. Like, that's just insane, right? So But yeah, like I don't talk about that much, but my profile obviously links to my company. I've got, you know, a header image that talks about my company. If people are curious about me, they will come to my profile and they read about the company. So I know for a fact, because this is the question that comes up, like the first question that comes up in my demo, the demo that's delivered through eWebinar, I guess to give people context, like we automate webinars with a video. So you turn a, like we turn a video into a webinar that you can set on a recurring schedule or make on demand. But what makes us special is we've got a chat component that allows you to hop in to respond live or respond later through email. And we have 20 different interactions that you can build into the webinar. So it's a poll, you know, sales alert, question, you know, a tip, things like that. So it's more of like an interactive video experience that you can participate in and not just like a Zoom, which is live and like someone's talking at you. So the first question that we have is, how did you find out about our company? And at the beginning, it was like 10% social media. And I'm not on any other platform. I'm only on LinkedIn. And then it was like 15%. But now it's like 20% social media. So I know it works. I know people come through. I don't ever have to talk about my company because they're going to find me one way or another.
Well, I completely, this is resonating, and this has been validated by a colleague of mine, Sean McDonald, who I have since like kind of brought into your LinkedIn weekly posts. And I'm like, Sean, you have to know about eWebinar. He didn't say duh, but he was like, yeah, it's great. We've been using it. Cool. And that's so beautiful. And Sean is someone, you know, based out of New Zealand and running the company Board Pro as a content director. He does exactly the same thing. Their weekly webinars with 400 or 500 registrants, they do not mention their software once. They don't even mention the word Board Pro, and yet their revenue is up 40%, over 2 million. So absolutely, don't just start and end with talking about your company. But before I pivot to like this whole entrepreneurship, Melissa, I'm so curious to hear from you in terms of, you talk about your personal stories and everybody kind of have their strategy, the corner, the writing that they're comfortable with. But let's just say I talk to companies on a regular basis, like AI companies, usually software company and some small business owners. And if they're not like you without your experience, and they maybe, some of them are just not comfortable talking about themselves and where they find it like not interesting, what are some of the things as like software companies and small creators and small business owners can think about that they can talk about? Like, do you have any recommendations?
I mean, there's so many things you can talk about, but the most important thing is you talk about something in your area of expertise that appeal to the audience you want to attract. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. And that's actually something that Justin teaches as well in his course, is like, think about what your niche is in relation to the audience that you want to attract, right? So I talk about my experience bootstrapping three companies because it's all I know, it's all I've done, but resource-strapped companies are our best customers. Like, of course, anybody can use our software, but we don't target, you know, the Googles of the world. I'm not an enterprise software, right? Like, our product is $100, right? Like, if I was targeting those companies, you know, I would write very differently, right? Maybe I would write about enterprise sales and like, you know, with a call to action to book a call with me or something. Like, I would want to position myself as like the enterprise sales deal closer person, right? But because I want to attract companies that are resource strapped or limited. So these are small, medium-sized companies or bootstrap companies. And because those make the best customers for us, I talk about bootstrapping companies to attract those people. So I would say, like, don't write about a topic that you want to write about because you think it's interesting, right? Because content is so hard that you need to be writing about something where you're never going to be, where you're never going to run out of things to talk about. And that is your area of expertise. And you need to think about creating content with an end goal, right? You're not just like putting things out there and wasting your time. Like, if you want to attract, you know, people in customer success, you need to write about your 10 years of experience in customer success. But if you don't have experience in that, the best thing you can do is borrow someone else's experience. So if you want to attract that audience, then maybe you want to interview, you know, the best CS people out there distill their experience and make those your posts, right? So that's, you know, what I would suggest is like start with the end goal in mind, who you want to attract, and either look into your own experience and, you know, start with personal stories and build credibility, or build credibility through research.
Very clear. And I love the advice. It's really universal, regardless of their vertical, the background that they have. So have an end goal in mind. And I think we talked about this already, but like before I pivot, I think about like the end goal for Melissa's content on LinkedIn. And, you know, for me personally, sometimes, you know, if I'm having a little rough day, if I feel like I don't know what to write about, is this entrepreneurship journey really worth it? I should just get a full-time job, which is never going to be a reality, you know? And then I read your posts and I just have this like, I don't know, like as if I'm going through like Sarah Blunden's meditation. I just like feel like put me in that state, especially when you said, yeah, resetting the alarm clock. Oh, it's just like, ew, I never want to go back there. It's gross. I don't want to say it's gross, but I know it's like some people just prefer having the structure, whereas I never did. Is that kind of the end goal, is to connect with startups, with founders, with creators, and give them peace of mind or something else?
I mean, my end goal is always revenue. Yeah. Right. Like, let's not kid ourselves. It's not a charity. I have, you know, I have bills to pay. I want the company to keep growing. I want to double people's salary over time. Like, I'm here to build a business.
Yeah.
But I'm not here just to build a business. Right. So my end goal, number one, is to get eyeballs to my company to make sure it is self-sustaining, because we are bootstrapped. Number two is I want founders out there to know that there are many different ways to succeed, that success looks different to everybody, that the only definition of success that matters is your own. Because if you look at VC-backed founders, they're all the same. It's an equation, right? Like, I raise money, I got to raise more money. So then I have to hit this growth rate and I build my company a certain way. I hire, I pump the revenue, I raise more money, I get into TechCrunch. Like, you know, that's an equation. Right? Or I IPO or I exit. But if you look at bootstrap founders, like the 99% of us, by the way, because only 1% of startups are funded, like VC funded, like 99% of bootstrap companies are all different, right? Like if you listen to Greg Head's, you know, Practical Founders podcast, every single story is different. Every motivation to build a business, every intention, every exit, every reason for exit is different. So I want founders out there that feel alone because their stories are not getting featured in the media. They're not reading about people like them. Like, I want them to know that they're actually the 99% and they're not alone. And what they're feeling and what they're experiencing, the failures and, you know, feeling like they're not good enough or that they're the only one that's not good enough, like, are actually the 99%. They just don't get talked about. So, like, that's, I guess, the second goal. But the third goal is, like, and this is just a byproduct that I didn't expect, is when you write, it forces yourself, like, your brain into a mindset that, like, it forces you to think about your business in a different way. It forces you to be more creative. And when I say I spend 5 to 7 hours cutting something down, it's kind of therapeutic because you write something and you're like, everything's important, right? But the post only allows 530 words. So then it forces you to think about all the things that are actually not important. So then you're left with really the thing that's important and the things that you should focus on. And I think that's really interesting. So writing has forced me to be more creative and also forced me to focused on the most important things by like trimming the fat. Whereas if it just allowed me to write a massive, you know, article, then everything would be in there. But what you're actually seeing is like probably 40% of my posts because I've already cut down so much of it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, your experience on top of that, you're probably cutting down even more. That I'm friends with a lot of Cirque du Soleil circus artists, and they say what you see on stage is maybe 5%, and they quickly change. That was probably 2%. And so how do you trim the fat? How do you go from this is all important to only these smaller portion are important? How do you make that decision?
I just read it over and over and over again. So that's like what I do first. I think it's most important to get your thoughts down because I want everything that's important about this topic, I want it to be here first.
Yeah.
Right. And then I put it in either a Word doc or a Google sheet, depending on like how long it is.
Yeah.
And over 2 days, I just read it over and over and over again. Not like obsessively, but like I'll read it now. I'll read it before bed. I'll read it like in a couple hours. Like when you sit on something and you revisit it, then you kind of see things that you don't like that you don't see after 2 hours. Right. And then I'll have my COO also read it and proofread it and like just fix the grammar and those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just kind of evaluate like, would someone benefit from reading this piece or not? Or does this sentence actually add to the story? Or like, if I took this away, would it change the perception or the change the visual of what I'm trying to provide? Right. So that's kind of how I make my decisions, but I just read it over and over and over again.
By the way, this is this conversation is like making me feel like that content high on content because I've been so obsessed with writing in the past 18 months. It's like 10,000 words on the blog and really getting in there. I just want to get the words out there and then trimming the next day, like you said, and even making it better over time. I've looked back on articles written 3, 6 months ago, be like, oh, I'm going to need to add something like this. And it just, it's so thrilling to hear this. And I would say, like, I feel like with your writing, that there's always, first of all, even before, you know, like Justin Welsh said that before the first three lines, there's something that's really hooking me and in a very emotional, very visceral way. And one of which I remember even from probably weeks ago, you talk about choosing lifestyle over business. And that just hit me right away. That's like immediately puts all the purpose on. Maybe I'm struggling a little bit here. I'm a little unsure over here. But I too, that was the first thing I've said on many podcasts. I want to choose lifestyle or business. I want to be able to bring my mom to her doctor's appointment. I want to take a break if I don't feel like it, you know, doing too much work today, whatever. Maybe I want to be there for my friends. So maybe could you, I would love to hear you elaborate on that a bit.
Yeah. So, I actively, intentionally chose and will continue to choose bootstrapping because I, when I moved to New York 7 years ago, I thought you had to raise money to be successful. Like, that's just what you do. Like, if VCs don't give you money, then you suck. And it's not a good business idea because all my friends were doing it or my community was doing it. And I tried to raise money as well because my previous business wasn't as good as this one. So I was in survival mode for a long time. And because I was raising money and nobody was giving me money, I also had to build a sustainable business. So I also had to be profit driven. And at the same time, as we were getting closer and closer to profitability, I care less and less about other people's money. And I was becoming less and less stressed out because I was able to slow down. Whereas my venture back friends were becoming more and more stressed out because they had to raise the next round and they weren't getting the revenue and they weren't hitting those growth numbers. And that was the majority of VC-backed founders. If, you know, not publicly, but that's what we talk about, right, behind closed doors. And so I saw both sides. And once we hit profitability, I didn't even care about other people's money anymore. And then that's when I left New York to travel full-time, did that for 3 years, and just had the best time, right? Like, and profitability allows you not just to pay your team, but it allows you to slow down, come out of survival mode, and think about what you want, the person who runs the company for years to come. What is something that you can do for you that can make this journey a little bit easier or that can make you happier? Because the healthier you are mentally, physically, the healthier company you can build. So having gone through that experience, I realized that I never want to invite a board and have board meetings and to justify my business decisions to someone else. I'm not going to work so hard to invite someone into my life to tell me what I can and cannot do and maybe have me fired if I didn't, you know, hit certain milestones, right? I just can't even fathom that. So I am now like a huge advocate for happiness over revenue and lifestyle over business. There are many things that I do every day that probably lowers the revenue of my company. Like I can work more. Right. I can work more. I can probably hire more people. I can probably bring everybody into a same space. Like everyone that on my team is remote as a contractor, I can probably bring everyone in the same space and, build a traditional company and have people also work harder and be more creative together. But I don't really want to do that because I also want to work with people who value what I value, which is working their own hours, not being as productive as possible, but working more creatively. Like I'm an advocate for working less, not more. Right, we don't need to work more. We know how to work more. We need to work more creatively. We need to make our we need to make sure that our time is better spent. So I want not just for myself and my co-founder David, who's also my life partner, to have the best life possible while building this company. I also want to make sure that everyone on our team has the same philosophy, because that is the company that we're building. Wow. And I'm very open about the trips we're on. Like we just took a 4-day trip in the south of Turkey on, on a yacht with some friends. Like I'm not trying to hide that from anyone. I want to make sure that our team knows that like, this is why we're doing this. And the benefits that we have for ourselves, we also extend to our team, right? So we don't have a vacation policy. As long as a customer comes first, that's number one. Mm-hmm. Like they don't need to ask for a day off. They just need to tell us like, oh yeah, I'm not going to be here on Thursday because I'm traveling. You just need to let someone know where you are, but the customer always comes first. So I think that's just like, this whole thing is hard. Why not make it funner? Mm-hmm. And why not have a life where work is integrated with fun and not compartmentalized? Because that, I think, is what makes it sustainable. And by doing that, I hope that we can attract not just the people that fit into this culture, but also the highest performing people. Because I also believe that you can be most productive if you can choose where you wake up in the morning and when you work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you don't work under fear, which a lot of corporations kind of still thrive on, it's different. It's like I really love Melissa's content. The e-webinar software is so solid, which I want to kind of get into, even though customer comes first. I never had any issues with the software. It's very highly stable. It is completely authentic. I have no issues recommending it to anyone. And as a result, I think, if we're in a working relationship, I can imagine like being your, contractors or employees, it just feels like, I like the company. I like the founder. I want to work harder. I choose to work harder, more creatively. That completely resonates with me. Even I have a much smaller company. That's kind of the message that I even say to people as soon the first Zoom call. This is what I expect. We're all remote. And I'm just curious, like how many people are currently working for eWebinar? I mean, roughly where they're located, because it's, like I said, it's very solid. I never had any customer support issues or something that's not working.
Yeah. So everyone's a contractor, right? Which actually allows us to hire anywhere in the world based on skills mm-hmm. and attitude. And this company just would not be possible if we had to hire locally. Like we just can't compete, right? Like we'd have to raise money basically. Mm-hmm. But we hire in places where we can pay people market rate or more. So most of our development team is in Vietnam because we mm-hmm. actually love Vietnam and we wanted a bigger reason to keep going there. So we have, five developers in Vietnam. David, of course, is my life partner, is our CTO. We have two developers in Ukraine. So just developers, we have eight full-time. And then myself, Todd, who's, our COO, but he's really our jack of all trades guy that like owns our content strategy, digital marketing. He's our product manager. Like he proofreads all my stuff. So he's really jack of all trades. So it's just me and him. And then we have like content writers on an as needed basis, depending on what they need to write. So is it a case study? Is it long form research? Is it, partner content? And then we have, a designer that we work with also on an as needed basis. So all these people we don't need full time. Mm-hmm. But so I guess full time, we've got 7, 8, like 10 or 11 that are full time.
Wow. Wow, that's incredible. I mean, I can't wait to produce some micro content out of this. I feel like there's so many lessons packed in this conversation. And I want to respect your time, Melissa. I think we only have about a little less than 10 minutes left. And I want to get into this, because you mentioned picking a blue ocean opportunity. I thought it was really intriguing. People like purple, sorry, not blue ocean.
Yeah.
Pick a
Don't pick Blue
purple,
Ocean.
don't pick blue ocean. Blue ocean's
Yeah.
bad. Purple ocean opportunity. And then I love the kind of the debates and the questions. What is purple? And then you mixing the colors and all that. So starting a company, sustaining a company is really hard. And I feel like you really cracked the code more than once. So please talk about purple ocean.
Yeah, just to give a background, like a context, Blue Ocean is an opportunity where you are the only company. Either in an industry vertical or like there's like very, very little competition, but you are basically the only company. Red ocean is when it's, super commoditized, like CRM, for example, right? Like if you start a CRM company now, like you are probably my hero. Like you must be super special, but that's red ocean. Purple ocean is when you take a vetted, like a business model that works. And you apply it to an untouched market or an untouched vertical. So I had my two previous companies in real estate tech were both blue ocean opportunities. So my previous company was like an open house check-in. So instead of walking into an open house, you sign your name on a piece of paper. We were the iPad check-in. There were like a couple small apps, like side project apps that existed before us. But we were the first real software company doing that, and the first one that was selling to enterprise, like brokerages and franchises. It was so difficult because we were the only company in the space. We were constantly educating people. We were never on the budget, right? So if you, it's very easy for a company that already has a bad CRM to buy a good CRM because there's like allocated budget and they know what this does. But when there's no budget and you've never spent money on this, especially as a company, are you like, well, is there ROI? Why did we never have it before? So where's the budget going to come from? We don't have a line item. If someone wants to buy us, they had to get rid of someone else, right? That's how they made decisions. So each sales cycle was an education, and then it was really long. And then because we had no competitors, they didn't know if we were cheap or expensive. So then we could never sell it for what we thought it was worth. Like we had to kind of like start with a low price and then over time, like nudge it up. So Blue Ocean is great if you know exactly what you're doing, if you have money and time to make this go. So perfect examples of Blue Ocean, which by the way, we need because we need Blue Ocean for innovation is Uber or like Tesla or Airbnb. Like we cannot imagine our lives without those companies now. But just think about how much money those companies have raised and how long it took to really take over the world. Most bootstrap companies don't have that time and don't have that capital. So what we did, and one of my friends told me this, like after Spacio was acquired, he was like, and he was like he was the best second mover ever. Like he wasn't in software, he was in like consumer goods, but he would find a product that he could improve on like 10 times and just sell it. Right after researching a company that's done it before him. So he opened my eyes to being second mover. He's like, why do you want to be first mover when the first mover has already done all the research and all the marketing? You could just learn from their mistakes. So with eWebinar, that's exactly what we did, was like we took a product that worked somewhere and we made it 10 times better and we sold it or we're selling it to verticals that never used webinar automation before. And because of that, we were able to cut down time to market. Like we basically looked at everything that was out there and we picked our 10 times feature, which was chat. Like a 10 times feature is basically the feature that somebody would switch for or somebody would sign up for. Like Jason Lemkin, I think, coined that term, your 10 times feature. And we were able to research like all their language, all their communities that they're in, what they've done before, able to do like a product to product comparison. So I think that like if you go into like I think Purple Ocean is probably the best ocean that you can be in, because it's like you can still take it into a relatively new market, but you know the product already works, And the customer that you're going after, even though they've never bought it before, can still do their own research and compare you with other products that are out there, and they know that this is built more for them. Right. So that's kind of my own experience, is like, if you're a bootstrap founder and you don't have time or capital to like ride out the blue ocean, it's probably best to pick something that's, you know, already out there, but make it 10 times better.
How did you convince some of these customers who are really considering, you know, webinar automation for the first time? Like you mentioned, they might not have done it or they don't really never allocated budgets. How did you convince them like eWebinar is a solution for them?
Well, I didn't have to convince them that, you know, they needed to, like, we needed to go into their budget because we're a cheap product, right? Budgeting only matters if you're selling enterprise. So, like, if you're like 10,000 and up, like, yes, someone has to allocate budget for you. But like, if it's $100, like, if an executive wants to put this on their credit card and expense it at the end of the month, they could do that. So that problem is no longer there. And how I convince them to buy something that they've never bought before. When someone comes to us, they have a very specific problem, right? Like, we don't do live webinars. We only do automation. We solve the problem of doing live webinars. So when they come to us, they're sick of doing them, or they're trying to do more of them because it works so well and they don't have the human capital to do it. So they're coming to us with a very specific problem in mind. That's why our conversion rate is pretty high. And I personally do not need to convince them because I don't do one-on-one demos. I just get them to go into our demo. Like, our demo is delivered through eWebinar.
That's right.
So when they're in my demo, they are getting the experience that their customer would be getting. Mm-hmm. And because the experience is so new and different than what they know, like, it's colorful, it's branded, there's things that pop up, there's things that they can do and click on, like hotspots and questions they can answer, and, you know, a chat that's automated. So now they're envisioning how they can run this and not have to be there 24/7 and not miss a question that comes from their customer. So the product itself actually starts to convince them through that demo process, which I think is, you know, it's cool.
It's brilliant.
And yeah. And even when a friend says, oh, can you do a demo for my friend? It's like, well, I probably can, but I cannot do a better job than what our product can do. So why don't you just sit through that? And if you have any other questions, you can ask me, or you can just like sign up on your own on a free trial.
This is brilliant. I love it. I realize the product really is selling itself in ways that no other tool can. This is fantastic. I feel like I'm sitting on a mountain of information right now that's resonating so much. And since we only have maybe a couple of minutes left, Melissa, what are some of the things that you want to talk about, but I haven't really asked, or something that you haven't really talked about on other podcasts?
Wow, that's hard. That's a hard question, because I've been on, like, in the past year, I've been on 100 podcasts.
Oh my God. Whoa.
Yeah, something that I haven't talked about. I'm not sure, actually. I think we've touched on a lot of different things. But maybe something that I wrote about yesterday is, so I nomaded for 3 years and found Amsterdam, and because we fell in love with it, and we're kind of sick of not having a home because we were just living out of a suitcase and living out of Airbnbs. We found Amsterdam. I've been here for 4 years, but I only spend about 2 or 3 months a year in Amsterdam, and then we travel kind of the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. But in a couple of weeks, we're going to make Thailand, like Bangkok, our second home. We were always going to spend winter there this year, but an opportunity came up to rent a really nice apartment with a friend of ours. So we decided to do that, and going to make Bangkok our second home and going to explore Asia a bit more. And I think what was interesting that I learned about myself is when work is really chaotic and you're chasing bills and, you know, you're in survival mode, like, I realized everything else, like, in my life has to be stable. Like, I can't take any more unpredictability. But as work becomes more stable, as we get closer to profitability, I'm actually craving chaos in my life. Like, I'm a big city person. Like, I love Hong Kong, and like, that's where my parents are from. I love New York. We miss New York, but it's too expensive now. So like, the joy of living in New York has kind of gone away, and like, we're Like, we just hate being in the cold also. Mm-hmm. But as eWebinar was coming to profitability, I realized I was like starting to get a bit antsy about going somewhere else. And like, I don't think bored of Amsterdam is the right word, but getting bored of where we are and just craving a new adventure. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Is like, I think founders love taking risks and going to the unknown and living in chaos. And as your company becomes more stable, one of the coolest things is you actually create or free up mindshare to invite more chaos into your life so that you're not bored, I guess. Right. Yeah. So I thought that was kind of interesting and a new thing that I learned about myself.
Yeah, I really enjoy reading that part too. I was thinking about Tony Robbins talking about people crave for certainty, but at the same time, there needs to be variety. Like, people want to be in the also stable relationship, but at the same time, they want something a little unknown.
Also not.
So it was very inspiring. Thank you so much, Melissa. I cannot wait to continue to promote and share eWebinar and also your personal stories, your LinkedIn profile, all the teaching that you've put out there. I'm just so happy to be able to not only see your post, but I even started to follow people who follow you. And I find those people inspiring as well. So thank you so much for curating such a wonderful community.
Well, thanks so much for having me. We'll be right back.